This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, January 8th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the Bradley Manning hearing continues in Maryland with the court looking at the issue of government overclassification. Environmentalists rally in New York urging the governor to maintain a moratorium on fracking in the state. And in Thailand, advocates say the decriminalization of prostitution could lead to better conditions for sex workers. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. India and Pakistan are trading accusations today of major ceasefire violations along the frontier in Kashmir. Shahnawaz Khan reports from Srinagar.
The Indian Army says that Pakistani troops crossed the line of control today and killed two Indian soldiers in the Mandir sector of Jammu and Kashmir. According to an army spokesperson, Indian troops intercepted the Pakistani soldiers as they were approaching an Indian post amid thick fog, and a gunfight ensued. Afterwards, the Pakistani soldiers, he said, later escaped towards their side of the frontier. This follows a similar claim on Sunday by Pakistan, who said that Indian soldiers intruded into the Pakistani side and attacked a post, killing one Pakistani soldier. Pakistan's Foreign Office summoned India's envoy in Islamabad on Monday to protest the incident, even as India denied the allegations. The allegations come as India and Pakistan are improving their diplomatic ties that were badly affected after the 2008 Mumbai terrorist attack. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
In the last 2 days, courts in Kuwait sentenced two people to jail for allegedly insulting the country's ruler on Twitter. Both men received two-year sentences. Rashid Saleh Al-Anezi was immediately jailed after his verdict was announced. His October tweet did not directly mention the emir, but the court ruled the posting was an implicit insult. Opposition protests have increased in recent weeks after the emir invoked emergency measures to change voting laws that many see as limiting their electoral voice. Amnesty International is calling today for officials in Saudi Arabia to release 11 women who remain in detention. They were among dozens, including children, arrested Saturday outside a state grievance office as they held up signs identifying relatives detained as part of so-called counterterrorism efforts. Amnesty's Philip Luther says the women simply exercise their rights to freedom of expression and assembly and should be freed unless charged with an internationally recognized crime. An independent journalist in Egypt is still in jail ahead of a military hearing tomorrow. Mohamed Sabri was arrested Friday as he filmed at a military location in Rafah. Sabri will be the first civilian to face a military trial under the country's new constitution. President Mohamed Morsi backed the contentious Article 123 that allows military trials for civilians for crimes that harm the armed forces. And prosecutors officially opened a probe of a wildly popular television host known as Egypt's Jon Stewart. Bassem Youssef is one of a number of media personalities accused of mocking the president in what many journalists fear is a crackdown on the press. In China, a standoff continues between journalists of a prominent liberal publication and authorities who recently censored it. Rebecca Valley reports from Beijing.
Hundreds of protesters gathered for a second day on Tuesday at the Guangzhou headquarters of Southern Weekly, a liberal magazine known for its hard-hitting reporting. The magazine is at the center of a heated controversy after state propaganda departments censored the magazine's annual New Year's address. The original piece called for constitutional reforms, but censored ordered they publish an editorial congratulating the Communist Party for its achievements. Li Datong is a pro-democracy supporter and former editor.
This affair is not just one small thing that ends here. It shows the great anger that all people in the news world feel against the media management system.
It is unclear if the paper will go to press this week. AP reports that negotiations are undergoing between editors and propaganda departments. Many social media posts on the issue have been shuttered, and mainstream media on the matter is heavily censored. Rebecca Valli, Free Speech Radio News, Beijing.
A new environmental impact study on six of Canada's pristine Alberta lakes shows increasing pollutant levels directly attributable to tar sands oil production. The study found that cancer-causing levels of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons in all six lakes grew as much as 23 times benchmark levels gathered in the early 1960s. Queen's University biologist John Small co-authored the report.
Most of the controversy in the tar sands region based on pollution has been argued that much of the pollution is actually natural, and that because the bitumen is so close to the surface. But using our sediment analysis, going back in time, and back in time is where we have most of these answers, I think we sort of have the smoking gun. We can actually show that these pollutants actually started to increase when the tar sands started operation, and they've been increasing steadily ever since.
Yesterday, a coalition of more than 70 environmental groups sent an open letter on climate change to President Obama, urging him, among other things, to block the Keystone XL pipeline project that would move tar sands oil extracted in Canada to the Gulf of Mexico. And protests were held around the country at offices of the pipeline's corporate owner, TransCanada, including those in Maine, Massachusetts, Michigan, and Texas, where at least two were arrested. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Doreen Marina in Los Angeles. A military judge ruled today that Private First Class Bradley Manning should get 112 days off of his potential sentence because he was unnecessarily put on suicide prevention watch while detained at Quantico's military prison. Manning's defense had previously asked the tribunal to drop Manning's charges entirely or greatly reduce his sentence, arguing the pretrial conditions violated the Constitution and international law. But the judge, Colonel Denise Lind, said Eighth Amendment protections against cruel and unusual punishment don't apply to pretrial detention. And according to Fire Dog Lake reporter Kevin Gostola, she said Manning was not held in solitary confinement for 9 months because he had some human contact. But many legal and human rights experts, including attorney Michael Ratner with the Center for Constitutional Rights, have called the military's treatment of Manning torture. Ratner told FSRN that the evidence presented at the hearings he attended reminded him of his client's experience at Guantanamo.
Bright lights, stress positions, no sleep, and stripping. And you look at what happened to Bradley Manning, you have to say to yourself, what they did to Guantanamo, they're doing to Bradley.
Manning, who faces charges that could result in a life sentence, was back in court on Tuesday for the latest round of pretrial hearings. This week's arguments will focus on whether Manning's motives for passing information to WikiLeaks should impact the tribunal's final decision, and whether the court can consider the issue of government overclassification. Government prosecutors have asked the court not to accept any evidence of motive or overclassification, but Manning's lawyer, David Coombs, argued Tuesday that both these factors are relevant because Manning did not know the information he leaked could aid the enemy, and that information shouldn't have been classified in the first place. In a speech in Washington, D.C. last month, Coombs said the charges Manning faces have a chilling effect on future whistleblowers.
If you can possibly aid the enemy by giving information to the press with no intent that that information land in the hands of the enemy, and by that mere action alone you can be found to have aided the enemy, that's a scary proposition. Right there, that would silence a lot of critics of our government.
No copies of Tuesday's ruling will be released to the public or the press. As with all other developments in Manning's case, reporters in the courtroom had to scramble to transcribe and understand the ruling as it was read from the bench. Ratner says the lack of transparency in the trial makes it difficult to keep the public informed.
So think about it. I'm a lawyer. I go into that court. The judge starts reading an order. This was the order about a plea agreement. And there's all these statutes mentioned, and she reads it quickly. I can't get a copy of the judge's order. There's nothing classified in that order. The journalists are sitting there. It takes 10 of them in a room to try and figure out what the judge just said. So it's impossible. So here you have a case that's about breaking secrecy being conducted essentially in secret.
The current motion hearing will run through this Friday, and Manning is expected to stand trial in March. After more than 2 years in court, the Pentagon agreed this week to pay about $2.5 million to a group of gay and lesbian veterans discharged from the military under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The settlement seeks to undo a policy that lumped those discharged for their sexuality with those discharged for drug or alcohol abuse and only paid them half their severance package. But LGBT rights advocates say much more needs to be done to end discrimination in the armed forces. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Though Don't Ask, Don't Tell was in place for about 20 years, this week's settlement only covers service members discharged after 2004 because of a statute of limitations on suing the government for money. Attorney Josh Block with the American Civil Liberties Union, who represented more than 180 veterans in this class action lawsuit, said the settlement is a positive step, but too little, too late.
You know, they're getting their money now, but if you think about it, the time you need that separation pay the most is when you're first separated from the military. The whole purpose of the separation pay is to ease your transition into civilian life. This does a little bit to make up for the harm that these service members suffered, but nothing can fully undo the harm that was caused by this discriminatory policy in the first place.
One of many impacted by that policy was Jonathan Hopkins, a veteran officer and West Point graduate who served in Iraq and Afghanistan until he was told to leave the military in 2010.
When I was discharged, because I was gay, I only got half the amount that somebody who was discharged for having a mental disorder or somebody who was discharged for being overweight. So it's kind of like saying you're only half a person. You only mattered to us half as much, already after they're kicking you out just for being who you are.
Hopkins, who works with the advocacy group OutServe, says he's encouraged by the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the outcome of this lawsuit. But he says gay service members won't have full equality until Congress repeals the Defense of Marriage Act. That law, which will be challenged at the Supreme Court this coming March, bans all federal recognition of same-sex marriages, including military families.
If you're gay and you're married, the following things you don't get. You don't get cost of living pay to help support your family when you're overseas. You don't get a housing allowance for a family. You get a housing allowance just for yourself. You don't get access by your partner for all sorts of base services like reduced cost child care. Your partner cannot, and your child can't get health care at the base hospital, and the government won't even pay for your health care. When you move to a different base, they only pay for you to fly, the soldier to fly, and they only pay for a single person's household goods. And if you die in service to your country, your partner won't get your back pay. They won't get all sorts of death benefits and everything else like that.
Hopkins and other LGBT rights advocates are also pushing for full equality in the military for transgender people who are still prohibited from serving following the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Protests continue against the Keystone XL pipeline, which will transport tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, to the U.S. Gulf Coast. Many are opposed to the pipeline's environmental and health hazards. A study published this week by the National Academy of Sciences found that tar sands production is polluting Canadian water bodies with carcinogenic chemicals. Opponents also say tar sands oil is one of the dirtiest fossil fuels and contributes to global warming. One key group protesting the pipeline is the tar sands blockade. They carried out actions Monday in several states, and activists occupied the Houston headquarters of TransCanada, the company building the pipeline. For more, we go to Ron Seifert, spokesperson for tar sands blockade. He joins us by mobile phone from East Texas. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks for having me.
There's been plenty of attention on TransCanada, the primary company constructing the pipeline, but there are other companies involved in the project as well, and they were the focus of some protests yesterday, including one in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where protesters focused on Michaels Corp. That's a contractor that is building the pipeline. Tell us about Michaels.
Certainly. So Michaels is a large infrastructure construction company. They are actually installing the Keystone XL pipeline. They have a terrible track record of spilling and not reporting violations to the proper regulators. They certainly, their hands are not clean in this process. This pipeline is only possible because of human rights abuses in Alberta. So those that are profiting from tar sands exploitation are complicit in those evils.
not just the construction companies themselves, but those who are financing the project also became a target of protesters yesterday, including the TD Bank in Portland, Maine. What about the organizations that are financing this project? What is their role in it?
Right now, tar sands exploitation in Canada is the largest capital investment project on planet Earth. Over $250 billion, with a B, billion dollars has been invested into different elements of that extraction process. That's, of course, greater than the GDP of a lot of countries on the planet. So the big energy corporations, the big multinational super majors, are all in on this. They're doing everything they can to rally support from the financial sector and, of course, use cashing in a lot of political chips. So there's a lot of power at stake and a lot of power being leveraged and manipulated to push forward this very dangerous and exotic form of extraction. These people have made their choice. They are telling the world that it's okay with them if the planet is destroyed so long as they profit from in the process. So it's up to the blockade and its allies to form a counter-narrative to say, no, that's not okay with us. We're going to do whatever we can to stop you.
Ron Seifert with the tar sands blockade. We're reaching you in East Texas near the pipeline's route. There were actions there as well, a hunger strike in Houston, the tree sit-in, and direct action in the path of the pipeline that took place. What's taking place there?
Well, actually, yesterday was the last day of the Houston hunger strike. The two strikers, Diane Wilson and Bob Lindsay Jr., made it 40 entire days without eating, and the result of that was a fairly weakened and dangerous state. So they did announce the end of their strike yesterday. The blockade will be releasing some more formal statements about that in the near future. As far as the tree sits go, the tree village reached its end around the holidays. So endured 85 consecutive days of folks living in the tree canopy of an old-growth oak forest that was slated for destruction by the pipeline. Unfortunately, TransCanada did simply reroute the pipeline around that blockade, moving the pipe a few hundred feet off to the side, which in and of itself is an amazing accomplishment for that tree blockade, because TransCanada had been telling landowners not only in Texas and Oklahoma, but everywhere in the entire proposed Keystone route from Canada to the Gulf, that their route was more or less set in stone, that rerouting or making accommodations for people that didn't want the pipeline on their property or going through very sensitive areas of their property. TransCanada had been saying all along that was impossible, that those changes could not be engineered, and it just was not on the table. However, when it was convenient for TransCanada, when there was a resistance to their route, they simply up and moved it, and it only took a couple days to make that decision.
We're just about out of time for the segment, but describe the arrests that took place yesterday. There were arrests in Houston, right?
That's right. There were two arrests. One of those is somewhat of an unusual arrest. Both arrests were for trespassing. One was of a journalist who was attempting to leave the scene and was dragged back onto the property and arrested, so it's still very unclear as to why that happened. But they were a journalist carrying a press pass, leaving when asked to leave. The other was a protester engaged in civil disobedience who had refused to leave the office because they refused to allow their air and our plant to be poisoned any longer. So both are in the Harris County prison system, but we expect them out in the very near future.
Ron Seifert is spokesperson for the Tar Sands Blockade. He joined us by mobile phone from East Texas. Ron Seifert, thank you for your time.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Environmentalists rallied in Manhattan Monday evening outside a fundraiser for Governor Andrew Cuomo. They urged him to maintain the state's moratorium on the controversial gas drilling method, hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. They say fracking risks sparking an ecological crisis in New York State. FSRN's Peter Rue has more.
Security personnel escorted guests dressed to the nines into the Waldorf Astoria Monday night for Governor Cuomo's birthday fundraiser. On the pavement in front of the luxury hotel, environmental activists set up a picket and held signs calling for a ban on fracking. Drilling opponents are concerned that the state's current moratorium on fracking, which expires at the end of February, won't be extended. Many are also criticizing an 8-page health department analysis leaked to the New York Times last week, which states that drilling could be done safely. Though a state spokesperson said there will be substantial changes to the nearly year-old document, critics of fracking see it as an indicator of which way the state is leaning. David Braun is with the environmental group United for Action. He says the state has not seriously taken into account the risk fracking poses to New York.
They're setting the process up for not a true evaluation of the health impacts from hydraulic fracturing, which is very disconcerting because we do know from a DEP, New York City DEP report, that 400,000 pounds of toxic chemicals go into each well. And we know of those chemicals that 33% cause cancer, 41% are genetic disruptors, and 58% are immune suppressants. So there is serious reason for us to be very concerned about hydraulic fracturing because they want to repeat this process over 100,000 times in New York State alone.
Braun and other critics also question the state's use of consulting firm Ecology and Environment, Inc., to study health impacts of fracking. They say there's a conflict of interest, as the company also works with oil and gas corporations. While Ecology and Environment, Inc. may stand to gain, others say they have a lot to lose should fracking get the green light. Jerry Wiley lives in New York's southern tier, near the Susquehanna River. She says her and her neighbors, who have been organizing against efforts to bring fracking to the region, might have to move if Cuomo lets the moratorium expire.
You know, if we can't stop Cuomo bringing it into the state, many of us are going to leave. So, and stop the fight. My sons are here. A lot of people's children are here. It makes it very difficult. It means we'd leave our children. And so this becomes a defining moment. We don't want to think about it. We haven't planned for it because we don't want it part of our consciousness. We want to ban it for the state.
6,000 people have signed a pledge to take nonviolent direct action should fracking be approved in New York. Thousands are expected to converge on Albany Wednesday morning for the governor's State of the State address, urging him to institute a fracking ban or, at a minimum, maintain the current moratorium. If not, many insist they will use their bodies to prevent drill bits from breaking ground. Peter Rue, FSRN, New York, New York.
The United Nations is calling for decriminalization of prostitution in Asia to reduce sex workers' vulnerability to AIDS. Researchers say a human rights-based approach that legally empowers sex workers will lead to a reduction in HIV and other health issues, as well as improve the lives and safety of people working in the industry. FSRN's Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok.
Bangkok's red light districts, the heart of Thailand's multi-million dollar sex industry, are crowded. Neon-lit streets with go-go bars, massage parlors and karaoke. Although prostitution is illegal in the country, officials often look the other way, allowing the red light districts to thrive. But sex workers continue to face harassment and assault, says Miss Noy, a 33-year-old mother of two. One client, promising taxi money, assaulted her in his hotel room.
He
hurt
me. He does everything what he wants. And I tell him I cannot do, but he's a big guy. He hurt me. I tell him not to do that because I have my period. But because he takes Viagra, he's like a dog. That time I was really hurt.
Noy says sex workers have little recourse when they are assaulted because police treat them like they're the criminals.
When I get out, I want to tell police. When I get out, I want to tell the police. But police in Thailand are no good. If I tell police, they must ask me, where you come from? If I say I'm from Papong, and then they say, why you go with him into the room? I cannot say, because sometimes I want to say I work in a bar, but police think bad of me. That's why I don't say anything.
Another concern is the spread of sexually transmitted diseases, especially AIDS. Although prevalence of HIV among female sex workers has declined from 2.8% in 2008 to 1.8% last year, and many sex workers report using condoms with customers, Noi says it can be a challenge to stay protected.
You have to be careful.
Because you have to be safe for yourself. I have to be safe for myself. Maybe you don't know, I may have HIV, or you have HIV. You have to be safe. We have to talk. Please take the condom. Please take the condom. You have to be careful about HIV.
Police can also be barriers to safe sex and HIV prevention, says Sarang Janyam, director of a local non-government organization, Swing, which works with male and transgender sex workers.
What we are work on HIV prevention.
We work with HIV prevention. In some areas, when we distribute the condoms for sex workers to use for prevention, they are afraid to get a condom from us because if the police say that they had a condom, they have to pay a fine. It's a big problem for HIV prevention among sex workers because they cannot reach prevention materials to protect themselves.
Prevention material to protect themselves.
The United Nations agrees. In a recent report, it examined 48 countries in Asia and the Pacific and found all but two, New Zealand and the Australian state of New South Wales, criminalised some aspects of sex work. Researchers say these policies limit access to health services, fuel discrimination, and lead to greater vulnerability to HIV. While many countries, including Indonesia, Vietnam, and the Philippines, harass sex workers for condom possession, others, including China, India, Myanmar, and Sri Lanka, require compulsory detention of sex workers for so-called rehabilitation. The UN report says in places where the government has decriminalised sex work, there are increased rights for workers, as well as high condom use and better access to STD and other health services. Thailand's Ministry of Justice tried to legalise prostitution in 2003, but failed. Swing's Khun Sarang says corruption undermines steps to reform.
The same problem, but nothing changed.
Nothing changes. I think the sex industry is big money. A lot of people get a lot of money. Many people would lose money. Just the sex worker, they don't lose money. But a lot of people who would have the power would lose the income. I think this is a problem. This is the reason why the law is not reformed yet.
Why the law in Thailand is not reformed yet.
But there has been some progress. Sex workers in Thailand have access to social security benefits covering sickness, disability, even a pension. Bangladesh, India, Nepal, and Taiwan all have seen Supreme Court decisions recognizing sex workers' human rights as guaranteed by national constitutions. And as part of its political reform process, leaders in Myanmar have pledged to work with the United Nations to help reduce HIV, including changing laws that criminalise sex work. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our Washington, D.C. intern is James Helmsworth. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.